Now it is my privilege to introduce tonight's honorary 10-minute speaker. Please help me offer a warm welcome to Sochi with 20 years of sobriety.
Hi, I'm Sochi and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Aunt Bill for having me speak by way of my best friend, who I tend to go everywhere with, and this sometimes happens to be part of the deal. So thank you for having me. 10 minutes is a pretty short time, and you have a really good speaker, but I'll give you a little bit of what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. Or if you can't hear that, then maybe what I used to think like, what happened, and what I think like now. Or what I used to feel like, what happened, and what I feel like now. Like I said, my name is Sochi. It's spelled X-O-C-H-I-T-L. It is Aztec Indian. It means flower. And it also means that I was branded terminally unique from the moment I was born. It is the very first thing I remember being uncomfortable about, having to spell it, having to pronounce it, having to explain it. And I was the type of person that just kind of wanted to fade out into the background and not be noticed. And instantly, I was always being noticed, like just, you know, roll call of first day of school. I was the one where the teacher stopped and got stuck. That's me. My mom was Mexican. My dad's Scottish. When I was 8 years old, they had a knockdown, drag-out fight called a divorce. And it was at that point where my mom went back to work full-time. I have a brother who's 2 years younger than me. So I would kind of take care of him when she wasn't home. And then when she did come home, I was supposed to stop taking care of him. And, you know, my dad came every other weekend as long as he had a check for my mom. And it was super uncomfortable. It was the first time that I remember just my whole life falling apart and it not being my fault and not really understanding it. And I used to... My mom used to get mad at me, and when she got mad at me, she'd tell me I was just like my dad, and I knew she hated my dad, so I was convinced that she hated me too. And it was my gig that I would just try to stay at school for as long as possible. I was a really good student, got really good grades. I did whatever after school or before school activities. I just wanted to not have to be the person that was carrying messages back and forth between my parents. And I know that, like, my very first drug of choice was sugar. I would lie, beg, borrow, cheat, and steal to get your candy. I would steal your candy, eat it, and help you look for it. I was that type of girl. And my second drug of choice was fantasy. I loved to read. I loved Disney movies, musicals. I loved anything that, you know, ended in then they lived happily ever after. And so I just loved to get lost in and not be in my own skin. I like to be in somebody else's story. And that worked for me for quite some time. But fast forward quite a bit. Now, I know that I had alcohol when I was younger. Like, my mom gave us, you know, a washcloth with alcohol in it when our teeth were coming in. I remember having sips of wine at fancy dinners. So I didn't think that drinking was that big of a deal. But I went to a private Catholic all-girl high school, and my best friend and I decided we wanted to know what it would be like to go to school with boys. So what it took for me was to have a drink, to A, start, you know, breaking the rules, sneaking off campus and then sneaking onto a campus where there were boys, and B, having to talk to boys. So the alcohol became something that I needed rather than something that I was trying, and it worked as a tool for me. And that worked for quite some time, what happened, you know, they talk about crossing that invisible line between drinking alcohol and becoming an alcoholic. My line was not invisible. It was white. It was on the back of a cassette case. It was handed to me by a boy, and it went up my nose. And after that, like, it was game on for me. I didn't have to pass out or throw up. I could, you know, I could keep the party going. I could remember what people had to say. It was fantastic for me. And, you know, I stopped liking the rules at my mom's house, went to go live with my dad, stopped liking the rules at my dad's house, and became a teenage runaway at the age of 16. By the time I was 17, I made a conscious decision that I was going to show my parents what it was like to love a child unconditionally, because I felt like they didn't do that for me. So I was working at the cookie store at the mall, and I found a guy at the Square Pan Pizza place next door, and we went off and had a baby. And, you know, to get away from all the drugs and the alcohol, I thought it'd be a good idea if we would move to Humboldt. Because I have some really clear-minded thinking, as you can see. And so we moved up there, and we had this baby, and all of a sudden, you know, I didn't have the rule book of, like, the happily ever after did not have, like, an appendix, and here's how you raise your child now. Like, that was not there. So we moved back down to his mom's house again, and I thought it'd be a good idea, the Catholic girl that I was, we should put a Band-Aid on this, we should get married, and move away from the drugs and the alcohol again. So we moved away to a place called Lancaster, California. And I couldn't understand, there were a bunch of houses going up, I couldn't understand why my new husband wasn't getting a job until I came home from work one day and found him in bed with a 16-year-old babysitter. And that's the second time I remember my entire life falling apart. And then I became a single mom who was, you know, doing what it took to have fun and raise this child. And I would, you know, I would go to work at a restaurant from 4 till 10, and then I would go to work at a nightclub from 10:30 to 2, and I would come home and I would do the dishes and rearrange the cupboards and rewire the vacuum cleaner, and I would still be awake when my daughter got up in the morning, because I really thought that, like, I had this going on. I had this perfect chemical alcohol balance working in my life that I felt like I was Wonder Woman. I used to call myself fiercely independent. I thought that that was a badge of honor. However, I like to take hostages. I mean, have boyfriends, and so I found another one. We moved again because the problem is always out there and never right here, and I thought that, you know, I thought that was going to be it, and one day he came home and told me to take my child and get the F out, and this is the third time I remember that my whole world fell apart in front of me, and mind you, there had never been a moment where I tried to, like, heal and feel better from any of these things, or tried to, like, look at what my part was, or look at what had really actually happened. Have any feeling whatsoever. I've been pouring drugs and alcohol on all of those feelings and all of that pain, and it stopped working. It just stopped working at one point, I decided I was going to stop taking my daughter to school. At this point, she was 11, because it was getting in the way of my drugs and alcohol, but I thought it'd be a good idea to get her a puppy. But we lived in a place that didn't accept dogs, so we were evicted, and lived in the back of this pickup truck until the guy whose pickup truck it was wanted it back. And I just remember, you know, I remember just being done with life. Like, I couldn't live like this anymore. And I don't know where my daughter was at this time. I wasn't the mom that was exchanging phone numbers and making sure that my daughter was okay. It was like, oh, she's at somebody's play date, and I'm on to do what I need to do. And there was something in the car with a skull and crossbones on it. And I drank it, and I chased it down with a bottle of Malibu rum, and I went to go give this guy his truck back. And what happened was is that we ended up being pulled over, and I ended up in the hospital with my stomach pumped, and they were asking me all kinds of questions about, you know, all the stuff I had in the car, and I didn't want to answer any of their questions. Went to jail. I was there for the weekend. My mom was the one, only one, who would come and pick me up, and I really did not like her. And I went back to her house, and I got on to the one thing that I knew would have the answer, because I knew there was something wrong with me. I had to go to Google. And so I looked at Google to find out what was wrong with me, because there had to be some kind of a doctor or a pill or a shot or something had to help me, because I was just, I knew I was broken. I knew there was something wrong with me. And it turns out my mom's friend told her to take me to a place called Claire Foundation down in Santa Monica. And when I walked in there, they started to ask me questions about, you know, how old are you when you had your first drink, and have you ever done this drug, and have you ever done that drug? And at this point, I was 29 years old, and I didn't want to tell anybody the truth, you know. But for whatever reason, I started to tell the truth, and I started to answer the questions. And what I felt, like, physically was that there was, like, this boulder that had been living between my shoulders started to just slide off, just to tiny bit. And they asked me to stay, and I said, but wait, I have to go get all my stuff and put it in storage. I'll be right back. And proceeded to go back to my brother's apartment and call every single person that I knew. And in about 20 minutes, I found out that I didn't have a single friend, distant relative, former co-worker. There was not a single person in the entire universe that wanted anything to do with me. And it was the darkest and loneliest I'd ever felt. And, you know, when I'm nervous and I'm freaking out, I tend to do things like wash the dishes and, you know, things like that. And I was drinking my brother's Coors Light, and I had the urge to go to the bathroom, and I didn't make it to the bathroom, and I peed all over myself. And it was that last moment of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And I got myself back to that Claire Foundation, to that detox, and I asked them to take me in. And in the course of the 30 days that I was there, we probably did 4 meetings a day. And I started to hear things. And one thing that I heard was there was a woman who had 6 months, and she had been doing the same stuff that I had been doing, and neglecting her child and just, you know, checking out from life. And I believed that somebody could have 6 months. I didn't believe that anybody could have more than that. But 6 months I could believe, because that's how long I was able to stay sober when I found out I was pregnant. So that one was okay for me. And then I noticed that there was a poem on the wall that was the footprints in the sand. You know, and I was the girl that was like, God, why are you doing this to me? Why aren't you helping me? Why is this happening to me? And I tried to remember all the times that I had gotten myself into some really bad situations, not just drinking poison, but other things too. And I wondered why I was still here, and I knew there had to be a reason, because it wasn't by my choice, that there was something else that had to been taking care of me. And the last thing that happened while I was in there was I came running out to tell these girls that I've been living with for like 20 days. Oh my gosh, did you know that my eyes are green on the inside and brown on the outside? And they're like, yes, duh, that's Hazel, we knew that. Which is fantastic. You know, I'd been writing that on my driver's license application, and I knew what color my eyes were, but I could tell you, at that moment, I realized that I probably hadn't looked myself dead in the eye since I was about 12 years old. And I'd gotten up close and personal with mirrors for all those times after that. But I wasn't looking myself in the eye, and you can guarantee that I wasn't looking you in the eye, because I didn't want to have to remember all the lies that I told you. And I was a liar, a cheat, and a thief. And I didn't want to see that look of pity and that look of disappointment in your eyes. And what I realized is, after being in all these meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, that the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous started to work in me, and I was able to look at other people directly in the eyes, and I was able to look at myself in the eyes. And I thought that maybe, you know, just maybe, God could forgive me, I could forgive myself too. When I left that rehab, I found a meeting that I'd been going to the entire time, and there was a woman speaking. She said that her name started with a Q, my name starts with an X, so she obviously had to understand how miserable my entire life had been. And it's the best thing that ever happened to me. You know, I did this step with the desperation of the dying, because I was dead before I got to AA, you know, and miracles happened for me on numerous occasions. It was hard work, and there was a lot of, you know, downs, and there have been a lot of ups, and but Alcoholics Anonymous has been a consistent in my life no matter what, and the people in Alcoholics Anonymous have kept me afloat when I've wanted to sink many, many times. I'm really excited to say goodbye to 2019. To be honest, it's been a rough year for me. It was the third time that I had a scare, a breast cancer scare, and this time the breast cancer scare was real. And I didn't for one second have a chance to be afraid and fall apart because of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I have been in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and because I have a family in Alcoholics Anonymous. And God worked some miracles for me. I happened to work at a church, and they decided that they were going to send me to Lourdes with the students that were going on a mission trip there, which is a place of healing water. And the day that I got back from that place, after being of absolute service for 12 hours every single day for 10 days, I went straight into surgery. And following that, I had only had to do 5 days of radiation. And after 2 months from when I found out that I had breast cancer, I was able to say that I was cancer-free. And that doesn't happen That doesn't happen on my watch, but it does happen when I have absolute faith in the program. I mean, the hardest thing for me to say is that four-letter word, help. But that's what's available here, and I have to realize that, you know, allowing other people to help me when I feel like I'm taking that from somebody else, it's actually a gift. It's a gift that we get to give to each other, to ask for help from each other. And I can never repay Alcoholics Anonymous for all of the miracles that it's giving me in my life. But I think that's all I've got for you tonight. Thank you.
It is my privilege to introduce tonight's main speaker. Please help me offer a warm Tulare County welcome to our speaker tonight, Lulu A. of Northridge, California. Oh my goodness. Multiple microphones. Way to go. Hi, I'm Lulu and I'm an alcoholic. But I'm sober today by the grace of God. Today the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is outlined in the first 164 pages of our book, A Good Sponsorship. The reason I start with that is because I'm the kind of girl who likes to take credit for things she doesn't actually do. So my sponsor says I need to tell you that up front. Is this the right one? I don't know where to... Oh my gosh, it's a lot. Ooh. Oh, my goodness. I was so excited, Brittany, that you were going to do the ASL, because I talk really fast sometimes, and I like to watch them very quickly try to go through that. I'm still very sick. That's a good one. Can I borrow that napkin again, though? I have a drinking problem, exactly. And I have just proven that to you. There was nothing sexier than that moment. Thank you. I'm so glad it's not a visual on the recording. Oh my gosh, I want to thank Bill for asking me, and Bill and Suzanne for being such gracious hosts, and the committee for having me. I have never been to Visalia before, and we had a really nice drive up here, and it's been beautiful and wonderful and fantastic. And my best friend Sochi for coming with me. She's mean, by the way. What she'll do, we go to events and she puts her name on her badge and lets people sound it out. Just want you to know she's a spiritual beacon of light. So I'm like, just write S-O. When I talked to Bill, I said, write this out. S-O-C-H-E-E. Honey said, is that how you spell it? I said, no, it's X-O-C-H-I-T-O. Bill says, say that one more time. S-O-C-H-E-E. She's been my road dog for a long time. It's really funny. We have the same sponsor. And it's been about 12 years now, 11 years. I walked into this room, and my sponsor, she collects weirdos, which, oh, yeah. It was funny. When I asked my friend, I was about 8.5 years sober. I asked a friend of mine, I said, I'm thinking of asking Quincy to sponsor me. What do you think? She goes, ooh, all his sponsees are completely nuts. You'll fit in perfectly. And I walked into this room and I was like, you know, I'm a contempt prior to investigation. I'm judging all these women and I'm not going to be friends with you and I'm not going to be friends with you. And Sochi was sitting there and she had just gotten a divorce and she was driving a mom van and had two young kids. And I thought I was cool with tattoos and stuff. And I'm not going to be friends with her. And my sponsor kept saying, you guys are exactly the same on the inside, exactly the same on the inside. And lo and behold, we are exactly the same on the inside. And I'm super blessed to have her with me. And I'm going to give you the statistics so you can start the judging now. My sobriety date is December 12th of 2000. I have a home group. It's the Pacific Group. And I have a sponsor. Her name is Quincy W. Three things I was told to get and keep when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, I'm supposed to tell you a little bit about what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And I always start with, my mom likes to tell the story about when I was 3 years old. When I was sick, I had about 102 fever, and
was miserable, and my mom gave me those St. Joseph's orange baby aspirins, the little chewable baby aspirins, and they tasted good. And they made me feel better. So when my mom went to sleep, I climbed up in the cabinet and I ate the whole bottle. Now, I'm not saying if your kid's ODing at 3 that they're going to have a problem, but you may want to save them a seat. And I'm originally from Chicago, right? I used to talk like I was from Chicago, and then I moved to California, and y'all made fun of me for talking like I was from Chicago, so I stopped talking like I was from Chicago. And we moved to Bel Air, California. Yeah, we were the Bel Air hillbillies. Oh, it's terrible. I mean, we were from the Midwest. It's the 70s. You guys were so cool in California. You were wearing, like, OP shorts and hang ten socks, right? Señor Lopez ponchos and Vans. And I was wearing, like, plaid polyester pants that came up to my neck and saddle shoes, and it was 1976. It was pretty bad. And I didn't fit in. You know, I'm this short of being cool. You know, I remember we moved to California. You guys were wearing Vans. I sent my mom off to get me Vans. And my mom came home with the Kinney version of Vans. For you young people, that's Payless. I know it's an old lady thing. Kinney, what's that? The old ladies are laughing. We all get it. Right? I got my saddle shoes at Kinney. And I didn't fit in. You know, I hear people from podiums of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, say they feel like they didn't fit in growing up, and I didn't. You know, you guys were cool. And I was smart, but I didn't really want to fit in with the smart kids, and I wasn't pretty, so I didn't fit in with the popular girls, and I wasn't athletic, so I didn't fit in with the jocks. But I found the stoners took me without an application. Down, we smoked a little weed, and you didn't care that I was wearing fake Vans. And that was it. Like, I just wanted to fit in with you. That's how it started. And, you know, by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I remember I told my first sponsor, I said, I just like to party. And she made me look up party in Webster's dictionary, and it says a festive gathering. Now, I'm not sure about you guys when you got to Alcoholics Anonymous. But for me, there wasn't a lot of festivities and absolutely no gathering. And, you know, I come from a decent home with decent people. You know, My brother's not an alcoholic. My brother's the weirdest guy I know. My brother's the kind of guy who drinks half a beer, puts it down, forgets where he left it. Right? I don't get my brother. My brother doesn't get me. He's like the good kid, you know. Goody too. My brother's a school teacher in Arizona. He and his wife have been married 21 years. I have been married 4 times, and I can't get to 21 years. Like, are you kidding? My brother has a wine cellar in his house. I swear to God, my brother, he keeps wine for like 10 years. Right? I can't keep mouthwash in my house. Like, my brother, he and his wife, they're school teachers. So they like to have their children at a certain time of the year so they can stay home with them during the summer. So my brother actually has unprotected intercourse with his wife at a certain time of the year. Right? So he can have his kids at a certain time of the year. I have kids when the stick turns blue. Right? And I'm shaking it like a thermometer because I want a different response, right? You get me, right? That's not a plus. That's a minus, I swear. Not again. Ah, guy's so weird. My brother is super beige. Like, he has... It was a few years ago we were at Christmas. My brother was wearing what I call the beige guy uniform. He was wearing a pastel polo shirt tucked into his khaki pants with a lovely belt and Crocs. He's sitting across the table from me, and I'm like, dude, how did we come out of the same womb? And my mother yells from the kitchen, he's mine, you were switched at the hospital at birth. You know, my brother's like super beige guy. Like, my brother has a beige house, a beige car, a beige dog, a beige lawn because he lives in Arizona. Like, just everything is super beige. I'm just Technicolor, and how we came from the same place is amazing. But I'm being raised with these people, and they're okay, and something's different. And by the time I'm 17 years old, like, I know something's different between me and my friends. My friends have an off switch. I'm sure you've met these people in life, these people who go, oh no, I can't drink this evening. I have to drive. Is that a consideration? Oh no, I can't drink tonight. I have to go to work in the morning. And by the time I'm 17 years old, I've dropped out of high school because high school starts early in the morning and I'm just not a morning person. And I've left home and I don't get that there's anything wrong. I know that I'm different from my friends, but I don't get that there's anything wrong with that. My mother, she's so cute. I was just with my mom for Christmas, and she's adorable. My mother's this cute, she's 5 feet tall, little Jewish woman. She's absolutely adorable. And she said, well, you know, you were just a free spirit. We didn't want to break your spirit. Should have done that, Mom. Should have broken. I mean, literally from day one. And by the time I'm 17 years old, you know, I'm doing things differently, and by the time I'm 21 years old, I have the outside manifestations of a drug addiction. In those days, we're snorting a lot of cocaine because it's not cool to smoke it, you know, and so my nose has been cauterized a bunch of times, my gums are worn away. I'm rewiring the vacuum cleaner at 3 o'clock in the morning, right? There's a drug problem there, And I decided that life was too much to bear. And I took 64 sleeping pills, 10 contact, washed them down with a bottle of Kahlua, and put on a long white gown to die. And won't you feel horrible when you find me? Unfortunately or unfortunately, the bottle of Kahlua, I'm a drunk dialer. No, I'm serious. I am so grateful that cell phones came along, like, around the time I got sober. Because I see these kids now posting stuff on social media. Oh, I would have been horrendous. I can't even fathom. And I'm a drunk dialer, and I called my mother. My mother's a therapist. All right. There's nothing worse than being put in a lockdown psych ward on a 72-hour hold, having been put there by your mom. Nothing more embarrassing, like the hierarchy of the psych ward. And I ended up in a lockdown psych ward for 3 months. And what I remember is, you know, they sent me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. What I remember, and this is my perception, is they were a bunch of toothless old guys, which I'm pretty sure that are about the age I am now. And these guys in this meeting, they talked about they had lost their job due to drinking. They had lost their family due to drinking. They had lost their homes due to drinking. And I was 21 years old, and I hadn't lost anything yet. And I knew I wasn't an alcoholic. But I knew drugs were a problem. I'm just not going to do drugs anymore. In that psych ward, they gave me medication. I love medication. I love medication that says, don't drink with this medication. Right? because you know it's going to be good if it's got a warning label. Oh, like you guys don't do this. Get into an elevator where the sign says wet paint and you got to go. And I got out of that psych ward with self-knowledge. Drugs are my problem. I'm not going to do drugs anymore. And I met a man. It's a lot of that in my story. Like I said, I've been married 4 times. I have a tattoo on my arm that says, seemed like a good idea at the time. I don't know if you can relate to that. It's brilliant when I think of it. And I met a man, and he didn't do drugs, and I'm not doing drugs anymore, you know, and we threw away my bong together. We're going to live happily ever after. And, oh, that poor guy had no clue what he had gotten himself into. And I'm a little promiscuous when I drink. I'm kind of a hoe. And so, actually, that didn't get any better when I got sober. I'm not lying. We'll get to that part later, but I ran around here for a long time acting just like that without a drink in me, so. But this guy realized what he was dealing with, right? And so he had a plan. He thought, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to put a little weight on her to keep her at home, keep her out of trouble. I had no idea he was dealing with an alcoholic, right? I draw lines in the sand so that I can move them. And you know, at 185 pounds, it's like, all right, I need to lose some weight. I need to do something about this. 200 pounds. Oh, man, I'm going to go to Jenny Craig tomorrow. And I woke up one day and I was 325 pounds. I love that when they do that. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. People get up to podiums and say they sold their kid for drugs and nobody bats an eye. I say I was the fat chick and everybody goes, oh, my God. She let herself go. But it's like anything else, right? I'm going to change it tomorrow. I'm trying to fix the way I feel. I like alcohol. I like prescription medications. I like Big Macs. I like Oprah. Horrible combination for weight gain. And that guy and I had gotten married and one day the stick turned blue, and I'm pregnant with my beautiful son, and I would love to tell you, you know, I for years was really proud of myself. I was like 9 months, no drugs, no alcohol, no nothing. But my son was conceived in a vat of drugs and alcohol, and I'm the mother who can't go 2 weeks after he's born and breastfeed without something in my system, right? And I have my son, and I had seen every movie of the week, you know, where they put the baby on the mom's chest, and it's this beautiful moment. And I remember that moment. It was nothing but terror and fear. And how am I going to take care of this baby? I can't even take care of me because I got a pill problem, and I'm drinking. What am I going to do? And one day my husband came to me, and he said, listen, this 325-pound thing is not what I signed up for. If you don't lose weight, I'm going to leave. And I'm an alcoholic. When I'm backed into a corner, I can create miracles. And none of this diet and exercise, 2 pounds a week. They had a brand new thing. It was called a gastric bypass. I went in to see this doctor, and he said, you're the perfect candidate for this surgery. The only thing you can't do with this surgery is you can't drink. I said, that's cool. I don't drink. Much. And I went in to have this surgery. And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says I'm bodily and mentally different from my fellows, right? And so what that tells me is there was a girl. They paired me up for this surgery. She was morbidly obese, just like myself. She's not an alcoholic. And we go in for this surgery. And it's great. In those days, it was major surgery. They split you from the middle of your chest to your belly button. You were in ICU for 4 days. It was a big deal. And we went in for this surgery, and we came out. We're in ICU. And we woke up and we had the morphine machine, right? The one that's got the button that beeps when it's time for a dose. And this cute little girl, I swear I can hear it in my head, she looks over at me and she goes, I'm trying not to push the button because I don't like the way the medication makes me feel. Right? By this time, I have already taken the tape off my IV and I have taped down the button. Because I don't want it to beep while I'm sleeping. I'm going to miss a dose. And more importantly, if she's not going to use hers, how can we hook up her machine to my machine? Because that's just a horrible waste. I started to lose weight very rapidly. I knew I couldn't drink. My husband left anyways for a woman he met on the internet. I'm alone with my son. I have no idea how to take care of this child. And at about 6 months after the surgery, I start thinking. I don't have a drinking problem. I have a thinking problem. If I had a drinking problem, I'd stop drinking. And 19 years later, you and I wouldn't be sitting here. But I have a thinking problem. And I started to think, I wonder why I can't drink. I mean, what does that guy know? He's just a doctor. I don't remember the first drink I ever had, but I do remember my first drink after my gastric bypass. It was an airline-sized bottle of tequila, about this big. Chugged it down. Here's what happens for me. I don't have a stomach anymore. It's detached. My esophagus is attached to my intestines. So what I feel when I drink is this horrible burning sensation right about here. It's really painful. It cramps up my intestines. It feels like I'm going to poop in my pants. And then I'm drunk. Like that. Right? I mean, at 325 pounds, I can drink you and the Green Bay Packers under the table. Now I'm a cheap date. Also, by the way, I believe that the normal non-alcoholic person would be deterred by the poop in your pants thing. I say drink through it. Absolutely. Persevere. Be ridiculous. There's never a moment where I thought, hey, maybe that's a bad idea. Wear two pairs of underwear. Just stop. So at one drink, I'm drunk, and at three drinks, I black out. Now, what had happened for me before is I had blacked out here and there. I overshoot the mark, had a pretty high tolerance. Now I'm blacking out every time I drink. What also happens for me is I can't throw up. So I get alcohol poisoning. I go into an alcoholic coma. In the last year of my drinking, I was hospitalized 4 times for alcoholic comas. And if you would have asked me when I got here, do you have a problem? I would have said no. It's what I'm drinking. It's how I'm drinking. It's who I'm drinking with. I had no clue. It was funny. It's New Year's Eve. And one of my favorite stories was New Year's Eve, 98, 99. I went to see Marilyn Manson at the Hard Rock Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada. Don't have a lot of recollection of this evening. However, hospital reports and police records indicate that I was rocking out having a good time. And then, yeah, I'm a blackout drinker. I leave the party, but I'm up and animated and funny. Woof. And my girlfriends, I guess I met some dude, went off, and from the reports from the police, they found me in front of the Hard Rock Hotel face down with a black eye and a fat lip. I'm assuming I went from blacked out to passed out, and dude was not amused. I came to the party at 5 in the morning in 4-point restraints in the CAT scan machine at Desert Springs Memorial Hospital. Right? And the guy pulls me out of the machine, and I said, ooh, must have been some party. And he's like, you know, usually people in your position are a little bit angrier. I said, no, it's all good. And they let me out of the hospital. I took a taxi back to the hotel. I slept it off during the day. And that night I put scar makeup over my black eye and my fat lip because I'm in Vegas, man, and it's New Year's and I got some partying to do. You know, I don't have a problem. I'm just having fun. And I met a nice Al-Anon man after I got out of that marriage. My husband left. And I met a nice Al-Anon man who took care of my son and I for a year and a half so we didn't die while I was drinking. And then one night I went out with my girlfriends to a bar in Simi Valley, my favorite bar called the Treehouse, and I met him. Oh, yeah, you know him, right? The man of my dreams. He drinks like me. Got a crystal meth problem, so he's sicker than me. I knew I was in love because he was wearing his work uniform and it had a patch with his name on it so I could remember his name throughout my whole blackout. So we went back to that Al-Anon guy's house and we got my kid and my stuff and we're off. And he and I got married. Yeah, it's romantic, isn't it? We got married in our apartment because he was on house arrest. Oh, like you've never done it. Come on. Nothing goes better with a rented tuxedo than an ankle bracelet. Oh, the romance. And we were off, you know, and my parents disowned me in an email because they're techno-savvy. And they said, we're not going to watch you die, and we're not going to watch you take our grandson with you. And my response to those, F you, I don't need you anyways. And my son at this point is baggage, and I'm dragging him from bar to bar and dope house to dope house and bad relationship to bad relationship. And dude went to jail, and I was left alone to drink the way I want to drink. And things got really gross. And at the end, I thought it would be a really good idea to take a porn star who's known for sleeping with 20,000 women as my date to my company Christmas party. Oh, thought it was hilarious. We're at the Rainbow on Sunset Boulevard, and went to my company Christmas party, and that night everyone was drinking apple martinis. They're beautiful, and I don't remember much about that night. I'm told that I flashed my boss's husband for drink tickets, and we had quite an evening, and I woke up. I came to in the bathroom behind the kitchen with that porn star doing pitifully and incomprehensibly demoralizing things, and that wasn't enough for me. I stumbled out of that bathroom. I went back to the bar, drank some more, and blacked out again. I came to in an apartment somewhere with some guys I'm sure I didn't say no to. And they were nice enough to bring me back to the Rainbow, kind of push me out of the car while it was still moving, and I got in my car to go home. And I would love to tell you that that's a bottom for me. That's a Tuesday, you know. And I got in my car to go home, and I'm driving on the 101 freeway, and there's two cars on the road, and I see the red and blue lights behind me, and I think, wow, this is going to suck. And they pull over the guy next to me, and I go home. And the babysitter's yelling at me in some other language because I said I was going to be gone for 4 hours and I've been gone for 12. And I throw money at her and tell her to get out of my house because I got to go to work in the morning. And I go to sleep. I get up in the morning. I get my son dressed for school and I get myself ready for work. And I go to walk out my front door. And I reach for my front doorknob and I missed it. And I reach for my front doorknob a second time and I missed it again. What I learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous from you is that's a moment of clarity, because I was still drunk and about to put my son in the car. And I paused. And it wasn't enough to get me sober. It took me a few more days. That lovely Al-Anon guy had called me, and he got me into a treatment center. And I'm not going to tell you that I went to treatment to get sober. I didn't. I went to treatment to get everybody off my back. Like, you know, I couldn't pay the rent, and there was a sticker on the door, and the chain was coming next. And, like, my parents weren't talking to me anymore. And I lost my job. And, okay, I'll go to the treatment center. I am the girl who took all her drugs to treatment. I didn't know. Listen, 4 alcoholic comas, I was pretty sure you guys weren't going to let me drink anymore. But the guy who unpacked my bags in the rehab pulled out my Ziploc bag with 15 prescriptions in it. He's like, "Oh, what's this?" I said, "Those are my medications. They're prescribed by a doctor." He said, "You have a lot of doctors." I said, "I have a lot of ailments." He said, "Some of them are in Puerto Rico." It was different back then. And it was great because I think he knew I was ready to run for the front door. And he said, "Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take them up front. And when you need them, you can come get them." And I thought, awesome, this place is so much better than the psych ward. Because in the psych ward, they tend to over-medicate me. I like my cocktail much better. And that night, they brought in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you guys scare me to death. I have no idea how to deal with you. First of all, you're shiny, you're happy, you're smiling, you're clean, you're trying to hug me. And I went running up to the front nurse's office and knocked. Nice guy who unpacked my bags, nowhere to be found. Woman opens the door, "What?" I said, "They need 2 Ativan, 2 Xanax, a Valium, a Vicodin, a Trazodone, a Wellbutrin, and a Prozac." Please, I'm having an anxiety attack. And she said, "You can't have that here." And I said, "No, you don't understand," right? Because that's the cry of the alcoholic, is you don't understand. And she said, "Oh, yes, I do. The worst thing that's going to happen is you're going to hyperventilate, you're going to pass out on the floor, you're going to wake up, and you're going to be fine." Slammed the door in my face. She was absolutely right. My first week in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had to watch your meetings from behind a sliding glass nurse's window in the treatment center, right? Because when I'm hyperventilating and passing out in your meetings, it's just really disruptive. My second week in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had to sit in a chair by the door with my foot touching the outside wall so I wouldn't hyperventilate and pass out in your meetings. And that's what I brought you. I was going to do some of what you did when I got here. I wasn't going to do all of what you did when I got here. I actually liked going to meetings. I didn't have much of a social life when I got here. Meetings had my 3 favorite C's: cookies, coffee, convicts. I loved meetings. Oh, yeah. You know, right? You can use AA as a dating service. Odds are good. Goods are odd. Fishing off the family pier. They told me to take commitments. I'd take commitments where I would look cute and be the center of attention. I'd be your chit chick or your literature chick, wearing a really short skirt, really tight top. I was a lot younger then. They told me to get a sponsor. I got a sponsor in name only, because every time I would talk to that woman, she'd like tell me what to do. I'm not really good with authority figures. They told me to work the steps. I don't really like anything with the word work in it. I don't want to work at a job. I don't want to work out at the gym. And working your steps sounds like a lot. They told me not to get in a relationship my first year. I didn't. I slept my way through this fellowship and 2 others trying to get recovery by injection. If you're new, it doesn't work. Just saying. I got my first sober relationship at 1 year and a day. Woo! Followed the rules. Yeah. I've worked step none. I got no God and no sponsor, but we're going to meetings. He's been out of jail for 8 days. And we're in love. And in 9 months, he was loaded in my house. All my money was gone, and he was walking out my front door. And for me, this causes a problem because I have alcoholism. So what I have at this point is 1 year and 9 months of completely untreated alcoholism. And my alcoholism demands treatment. Demands treatment with alcohol and drugs or a spiritual solution as outlined in our book. It's 8 days before my second sober birthday. I had a plan. I was standing in my shower crying. I couldn't stop crying. I was going to buy a gun so I could blow my head off on my second AA birthday because I'm a drama queen. That's the best I got at 2 years without a drink. And luckily, I had trained my feet in Alcoholics Anonymous. I hadn't trained my brain here yet. My feet took me out of that shower and took me to a meeting where some wonderful women grabbed me, women who cared more about my life than my feelings. And if you're new, I hope someone cares more about your life than your feelings. And they said, you do some of what we do here. You're not doing all of what you do here, and you are dying of alcoholism. And on that day, I was desperate and willing. And if you're new, I wish you desperation and willingness. Because if you're not, you're not going to do the things we do to stay. I started to do everything they asked me to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a sponsor, started to work those steps. I started to do everything you guys asked me to do. I started setting up your chairs and picking up your cigarette butts. We were talking about H&I earlier. I was big doing H House of Service. I was really busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I only had one problem with your steps. God. You guys kept talking about God. See, I came from a home where I'm a nice Jewish girl, right? And so, like, my mother will tell you, she raised me right, I went left. And she says, I'm the only Jewish American princess that aspires to be poor white trash. With every tattoo I get and every convict I marry. In multiples. And my mother, like, you would hit your knee on the coffee table, and my mother would go, God punishes. I haven't even done anything yet. I don't want your God. I'm going to just skip that part, and everything's going to be fine. And I got really busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you, if you get really busy around here, what happens is your life gets better. Right? You guys taught me how to suit up and show up for a job, and I got better jobs. At 3.5 years sober, I got my kid back. Like, stuff was looking good on the outside. At 6 years sober, I met a man in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we got married in a big AA wedding. 238 of our closest friends. I'm driving a BMW. I've got a good job. We buy a house. It looks so good on the outside. I know. You've heard this story. And at 8.5 years sober, I started thinking. Because again, I have a thinking problem. I don't have a drinking problem. I start thinking, I don't think you guys are doing all these things that you say you're doing here in Alcoholics. Rigorous honesty? Really? That's a lot. And it started out really simply with illegally downloading music because I think I'm entitled. Oh, yeah. And then I thought it was okay to cheat on my taxes. And then I thought it was okay to cheat on my husband with a 24-year-old boy who had 18 months sober and no regard for his welfare whatsoever. And I was doing really shady stuff in and out of these rooms. And because I can talk a good game, I'm sponsoring half the people in my area. Right. I'm trying to transmit something I don't have. And I'm dying in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the problem is I have 8.5 years sober, and my first drug of choice is what you think of me. So now I can't tell you because I have 8.5 years. And luckily, the woman who is my current sponsor came into my life, and she said, you're going to drink. I was like, no. Don't you know who I think I am? She said, you're the prom queen of the leper colony. Now what? You're popular in Alcoholics Anonymous. Woo, head table at the mental hospital. And she opened up that book and showed me where it said that if my motives didn't change, I was sure to drink. And at 10 years sober, I was standing in a bar in Las Vegas, Nevada, a bar I had been in a million times for cocktail parties, and I had a thought. Like I said, I have a thinking problem. I had a thought. And that thought was, you know, if I weren't an alcoholic, I wouldn't have to live up to this spiritual garbage. And I knew I was going to take a drink. My sponsor taught me that everything I do is walking towards a drink or walking away from a drink. Not just in here, but out there. Because I can be a spiritual beacon of light in here with you. Sit next to me on the freeway and see. And I called up that woman and I said, you're right, I'm going to drink. What do I do? And she said, well, it's a program of principles. And you don't have any. The first one being honesty. And the second one being humility. And what I found was that when I got honest, humility soon took care of itself. Because when people in Alcoholics Anonymous found out I had cheated on the nicest guy in AA, people weren't nice to me. People in my own home group would walk up to me and go, and walk away from me. Which was great, because you couldn't be my higher power for one more minute. God could and would if he were sought. I'm not a seeker. That's another one of those action words. I sat in meetings for years going, it's going to come to me, whatever it is. And a God of your own understanding, whatever. I had to go seek. I lost everything. I lost that marriage. I lost that beautiful house. I totaled my pretty BMW texting because I was so important. I couldn't miss that text. And anything that got between me and God went away. I ended up in a guest house in someone's backyard seeking God and having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. It's all I get. See, the problem is in meetings, they read the as the, and sometimes it sounds like, and I think I'm getting something else here. I love cash and prizes. I'm a stuff seeker. And that stuff will come and that stuff will go. And I ended up seeking God. And I ended up, I'm a practicing Buddhist, which in L.A. makes me a Buju. And if you would have asked me in my first 10 years if I had worked the steps, I would have said yes. If you would have said, how's my 11th step practice? I would have said, meditation makes me uncomfortable. So does not drinking. It's a step. Right? Everything for me had to change. Everything had to change. And I guess it was a couple years later. I met a man. Again. I know. But this time he was in another country, so it was so much better. Seemed like a good idea at the time. I was working for a company in England, and I was on one of my trips, and I met a guy there, and I thought, I'm going to move to England. I married him in Vegas. We got married by Elvis. It was really romantic. It's just been such a romantic ride. And I went off to England. I abandoned my best friend and, you know, left my grown son and my parents. And I went, England is going to be great. They have AA there. Let me tell you, I didn't move to London or somewhere really cool in England. I moved to an area called the Midlands, which is like the Oklahoma of England. And not even like Oklahoma City. It's like Enid, Oklahoma, right? Big agriculture, cows, sheep, chickens, the whole deal. I'm an L.A. Valley girl. I'm like, this is going to be great. I'm going to be fine. And meetings there, you know, I'll tell you, it was very different. I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. There's Alcoholics Anonymous everywhere. Let me just tell you, they are a glum lot. They are. A different world there. And it was miserable. You know, I got sober in a place, Bill and I were talking about it, you know, I got sober in a place where circuit speakers were at my local meeting every day, and I had no clue what I had, and I moved to this place, and in this place we had the same 8 people. The meeting would move from town to town, right? Every night was at a different town. There was one meeting, you had one choice, and it was the same 8 people everywhere you went. And I was miserable, and they were complaining about their day, and they weren't in the book. I was all about the book. I would go to meetings and there wasn't even a book in the room. They would tell me, they would say, you know, we want to hear more about drinking. I'm like, what's an AA meeting? I thought, we all know how to drink. I thought maybe you wanted to hear about recovery from alcoholism. They go, no, lassie, no. There were also no women. And when I got sober, you know, you guys told me to hang out with the women. I didn't like women. Women, you guys are easy. Men are so simple, right? Easily manipulatable, malleable, all that great stuff. Do what they want. Women, oh, they, you know, call you on your stuff. They steal your man. Nobody wants to be with women. They're like, go to the women's meeting and shut up. And by the time I had gotten to England, I loved being with women. And there were no women. There were two women there. There was one woman who had like 22 years sober, and there was a girl who had about a, well, less than a year. And within 6 months of my arrival, the woman with 22 years sober was diagnosed with cancer and passed away. And I'm calling my sponsor every week, and I'm like, I'm going to die here. I got no sponsees. I got nothing. I'm crying. And she said, just keep showing up with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and be the example of Alcoholics Anonymous that you know. And I kept showing up, and I kept showing up. And this life at home with this man that I had married, turns out he was a using addict, and I had no clue. Because from 5,000 miles away, you can hide that stuff great. But when you live together, it's a little harder. And I'm going to meetings, I'm going to meetings. And then one woman showed up. And then another woman showed up. And then another woman showed up. And while I was there, I ended up sponsoring 17 women. And taking them through the book the way I was taught. And by the time I left there 4 years later, I knew what my purpose had been there. It wasn't about the guy. Right. But see, my God knows me very clearly. And my God knows that if I would have been like, you know, doing my thing, and God would have come down himself and said, here's what I need you to do. I want you to go to the middle of England, cows, sheep, all this stuff. And I want you to do my work. I would have been like, dude, I live in the valley. I'm busy. So you gave me a cute guy with an English accent and off I ran. Okay. But by the time I came back here, I knew my purpose. And actually, it was a few months ago, my grand sponsee there sent me a text, and she said, I just want to thank you for taking my sponsor through the book this way, because today I'm sitting down with a new girl and taking her through the book. God's purpose for me is always better than I think it is. I'm going to tell you a couple stories about amends, and then I'm going to sit down. I really believe in amends. I believe that everybody is terrified of their fourth step and their fifth step and all that stuff, and they say you get free there. I swallowed some big chunks of truth about myself in the fifth step, but I really got free when I paid them back their money, when I did, you know, when I made proper amends. I'll tell you about, I had a resentment for 16 years. Oh, it was a good one. I can tell you the day it started. 1999. I was going to Woodstock 99 in upstate New York. My dad died when I was 24 years old. My uncle handled his estate. I didn't really like the way my uncle handled his estate. I really thought he was going to step up and be more of a dad, and he hadn't done that. And on the way up to this weekend, I stopped to see my family. They were in Connecticut. And my uncle walked into the house, said hello to me, was there for 10 minutes, and he left. I said to my aunt, where did he go? She said, you remind him too much of your dad, and he had to leave. And I was mad. How dare you? You're the grown-up. What do you mean you left? And I never talked to anyone on that side of my family ever again. So I get sober, and you guys have me write an inventory, and you say, who do I resent? Well, I don't resent those people because I don't talk to those people, and they're not on my list even. I'm going about my business. And, you know, early in sobriety, I guess it came around, you know, social media. I call it the amends maker. Oh, yeah, right? Don't tell your sponsor. I can't make amends to Judy. I can't find Judy. Ding! You have a friend request from Judy. So the first friend request I got was from my cousin Margot. She's adorable. She's the other black sheep of the family. It was her dad, and She likes to marry convicts as well. And she friend requested me. I thought, I'll let her into the inner sanctum of fabulousness that is my Facebook page, right? And we started chatting. She knew I hated her parents. We never talked about her parents. Everything was good. And she lived in New York. And I would go to New York on business a lot. And every time I'd go to New York, we'd have dinner. We'd have a good time. We never talked about the family. Everything was great. And a few years ago, I was typing to her, telling her I was coming to New York. And my God is really strong. Sometimes my God speaks through my mouth or types through my fingers. And I was typing to her, and all of a sudden I typed, "How are your parents?" She said, "Well, they're okay. You know, they're 85 years old. Mom has dementia. Dad breaks bones a lot. But they're okay." And the next thing I typed was, "Do you think they'd want to see me?" And she said, "I know they'd want to see you. They always ask to see your Facebook page, and every time we meet, they want to know everything about you." And I knew it was time to make this amends. But of course, me being me, I'm riding the train to upstate New York, and I'm getting angrier. I remember what you did to me. You hurt me. I'm mad. I'll tell you about it. My uncle was in the hospital. He had broken the upper half of his leg. We opened the door and walked into this hospital room, and I'm fuming. And there were these two little, frail, old people standing there. And my resentment went away. And luckily, I did what you taught me to do. I sat down with them, and I said, "I was wrong for what I did to you. What can I do to make it right?" And then I stopped talking, and I listened. And my uncle said, "You know, I'm still really mad at your dad." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because he had a death wish." Death wish. And he said, "Well, you know, when he got diagnosed with the cancer and they were doing the chemo, they told him he had to stop drinking. And he wouldn't stop drinking." And I said, "You know, I don't think he had a death wish. I think he thought he was special and different. I think he thought the rules didn't apply to him. I think he was an alcoholic, and I don't think he could stop drinking." And he said, "Why do you think that?" I said, "Because I think I'm special and different. I think the rules don't apply to me. I'm an alcoholic, and I can't stop drinking." And I spent the next hour explaining to those people what alcoholism is and what it looks like. And in that hour, not only did I get free of my resentment, I got to free them of theirs. And you didn't tell me that was going to happen. And by the end of that visit, you know, I had climbed into the hospital bed with this 85-year-old man, and we were taking selfies for my Facebook page and talking about getting matching tattoos. Yeah. And that family was healed. And then there's my brother, my beige brother. All my mother ever wanted was for my brother and I to have a relationship. I don't get along with him, Mom. He's a judgmental jerk. He's perfect. Anybody got a perfect brother? He's perfect. When my dad died, I was 24 years old. My brother's 3.5 years younger than me. He was away at college. He couldn't deal with it. He couldn't handle it, and he didn't come home. He did the best he could, right? And I had to go through all my dad's stuff. My dad was kind of a high-end hoarder, and I had to go through everything and do everything myself, truckloads of stuff and all this stuff. And my brother had said to me, "There's one thing I want of Dad's. I want his Movado watch." He had a very special Movado watch. And so when I was going through my dad's stuff, I come across the Movado watch. I stuck it in my pocket, and I never gave it to my brother. Like you wouldn't do it. So when I'm 10 years sober and my life is completely on fire, and I mean on fire, right? I've cheated on the nicest guy in AA. I owe the IRS $77,000. Everything is miserable. I'm calling my sponsor in tears, and people in AA aren't being nice to me. I'm like the I'm wearing the scarlet letter, and I walk into meetings like, oh, God, it's her. My sponsor actually said to me at that point in time, she goes, you know that thing you have where everybody needs to like you? And I said, yeah. And she said, oh, people hate you. I was in a meeting the other day. They were talking about you right in front of my face. I'm like, oh, God, the knife, right? So I'm calling her every day. Girl, oh, my life's a mess. One day she goes, why don't you give your brother the watch? I don't think you're hearing me. My life is a mess. Why don't you give your brother the watch? I'd hang up the phone. The next day I called. Why don't you give your brother the watch? Like, seriously, you sponsor people with this repetitiveness already. Day three. Why don't you give your brother the... Okay, my God, Jesus, give my brother the watch. I went to the jewelry store, and I had the watch cleaned up and had a new band put on it, had it put in a nice box, and I called my mom. My brother was in town, and I said, I'm going to pick up Josh and take him to the airport. My mother said, you're not going to kill him and hide the body, are you? No, Mom. So I went and I picked up my brother, and we're driving down the 405 freeway to the airport, and I said, I was wrong for what I did to you. What can I do to make it right? And I handed my brother the watch. My brother opened up this box, and he started to cry. And he said, do you know what it was like to be your brother? And I said, no, why don't you tell me? And he said, I was just a good kid, doing the best I could. And they didn't even know I was alive. Right? Because Lulu's in the principal's office again, and Lulu's in jail again, and Lulu's at the hospital again. He goes, and I was just a good kid. And I had never seen it from my brother's point of view. I just thought he was a goody two-shoes that did everything right. And in an amends, what I've learned is I don't just say I was wrong. I have to amend the behavior. Because if I don't change, I might as well not even say I was wrong. And so what I started to do is I started to make my brother the center of attention. My brother is a school teacher. I respect what he and his wife do, man. They take care of kids for no money, work their butts off. I started to make everything about my brother. I'm big on the social media thing, and I started talking about my brother. I started raising money for his girls. He coaches volleyball and doing all that stuff. And, you know, just made him feel big. My brother and I started to build this relationship. And, you know, it started to be when I would come back from England and I'd go to Arizona, he was excited that I was coming to town. We just started to build this relation. My mother was so happy. So the beginning of this year, they announced the NFL football schedule. And it seems that my Chicago Bears were playing his Oakland Raiders in London. Now, my brother's never been anywhere. My brother's a really super responsible guy. Like I said, he's beige guy, right? He pays his house payment. He's got two kids about to go to college. He's a responsible dude. I'm the girl who's, you know, flitting all over the world, been married a bunch of times, doing whatever I want to do. And so I called my brother. I said, if your wife will let me, I want to take you on a trip. I want to take you to see this football game. And he cried. And so on September 28th of this year, my brother and I took off from Los Angeles International Airport. And we went to Edinburgh, Scotland, and we went to Liverpool. And I took him to meet all my friends in the middle of England, and we went to London. And he's a big soccer fan, and we got to go see Arsenal, which is his favorite team. And we got to see our football teams play. The Raiders won. I told him it was part of the amends. You know, my brother and I were sitting there in a hotel room just laughing, having the best time. And my mom had said to me a million times, you guys are so much alike if you just get to know each other. And we were laughing, having the best time. I thought, we are so much alike. I have to tell you now, I don't know, if you're new, I don't know what your miracle is here in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you would have told me when I was new that my miracle was going to be taking my brother on a trip to England, I would have been like, I'll pass. It's a miracle I can miss. That's my miracle. Because I've suited up and shown up and done everything you guys have asked me to do, and I've got a power greater than myself that solves my problems. And in that, everything's okay. You know, today I have peace. I didn't want your peace when I got here. You know, I listened to heavy metal music, and I rode a motorcycle, and I wore a leather jacket, and I thought I was cool. I actually had a guy tell me, I think I was about 8 years sober, and he said, maybe if you wouldn't listen to angry white boy music, you wouldn't be such an angry white boy. So I started listening to Britney Spears. You can laugh all you want, but you can't be mad when you listen to Brit. Like, I saw these women when I got here, and they were like hippies and had crystals and all this stuff, and I'm like, I'm never going to be that. And now I am a 53-year-old hippie, crystal-wearing, meditating hippie. Man, that's what's happened. But today what I have is peace. So I didn't know I wanted peace when I got here. I didn't even know what it was until I got it. Now that I have it, I wouldn't sell it to you for $1 million. But I will give it to you if you ask me. So thank you. Thanks.